Thank you for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Today we have a very interesting and inspiring show with one of America's leading industrialists, Dr. T.J. Rogers, CEO of Cypress Semiconductors. Dr. Rogers earned a PhD in electrical engineering from Stanford University and started Cypress Semiconductors in 1983. Today, Dr. Rogers is the longest-serving CEO of any semiconductor company in the world. Throughout his 30 years as chairman of Cypress, Dr. Rogers helped keep Cypress Semiconductors a world leader in the semiconductor industry. In today's interview, Dr. Rogers discussed why he became interested in science, how he came to study chemistry, physics, and electrical engineering, and how he is revolutionizing the wine-making business with his technological innovations, which are based on chips made by Cypress Semiconductors. Dr. Rogers also talked about why free enterprise is important and how free enterprise has helped him and others become part of America's richest 1% when they started out with modest financial backgrounds. Thank you very much for joining us today, and we would also like to thank Dr. T.J. Rogers for his time and for this interview. To start today's interview, I asked Dr. T.J. Rogers why he became interested in studying science.
To a very good grade school in Oshkosh, Wisconsin that had science teachers and math teachers. My scientific career really started with my mother. She was a teacher of a radio electronics during World War II. So she was drafted into World War II, and they tested her and sent her to St. Louis University, where she learned electronics and taught it for all of World War II. She influenced my career. I remember being taught by her when I was a kid, looking at her vacuum tube electronics books that she used during World War II.
So did you do a lot of scientific experiments as you were growing up?
Yeah, I did a lot of experiments when I was a kid. I made all kinds of things. Some of them were good, some of them weren't good. I blew up the chemistry laboratory in high school, burned myself, put myself in the hospital for 2 weeks. Yeah, I was always working on some project, always.
Could you give us examples of some of these projects?
I liked gas-powered engines, so I made airplanes and boats with gas-powered engines in them. I liked electronics, so I made various simple electronics projects. I liked rockets, so I made rockets that, you know, launched pretty much what kids do today.
What advice would you give parents who would like to encourage their children to study science?
I would advise parents not to push their children in any one direction. If somebody's interested in art or theater or writing, let them alone and let them do what they want to do. One thing I believe very strongly is that your passion has to be involved in what you do, or you will never be any good at it because it'll be a job. I don't think parents should push people in a given direction. It will be a mistake. There's a book called Outliers, which is about some well-known, very rich, very successful people. For example, it includes Bill Gates, Bill Joy of Sun Microsystems, now of Oracle. And these players were important in their field because they had deep passion for what they did. The book actually talks about them and talks about even the Beatles, who spent 10,000 hours playing in junky nightclubs when they weren't famous until they got completely automatic in their craft. In the case of Gates and Joy, they spent 10,000 hours in a computer laboratory where they would work all night long because in the days when they were training, computer time was very scarce and very expensive. So they would get a job running the computer center at night, and then they'd use the computer all night long. So you have to have passion that drives you to work crazy hours in order to succeed, because you'll be competing against people who do have passion and will work crazy hours. And therefore, I don't think parents should push their kids in any direction. Certainly, why don't you be a doctor or a lawyer so you can make a nice living is really bad advice. If you want to be a doctor, great, be a doctor, but don't do it because your parents say that's the way to make money.
Your bachelor's degree was in chemistry and physics, and then you came to Stanford and got a PhD in electrical engineering. Could you walk us through how your passion changed from chemistry to physics to electrical engineering?
I've always liked chemistry, and my interest in chemistry over my life has waxed and waned. In high school, I was sure I wanted to be a chemist. Then I blew up the laboratory, and I was expelled from the chemistry lab. Then I went to Dartmouth and took chemistry there. And I was almost done with my chemistry degree. I only had a few more courses to take, and I got bored with chemistry. And specifically, I got bored with organic chemistry. So then I decided the physics courses I was taking were more fun. And I got into physics, and I finished my chemistry degree, and then I had to hurry up and take all the physics courses, which I did. And in my very last quarter of my senior year, I got bored with physics, and I didn't like it either. And the thing that bored me was solid-state physics, where, for example, you solve problems of electronic and heat transport through materials, which I didn't care about. It was difficult and uninteresting, which is a bad combination. In my last quarter of my senior year, I took, as a lark, an electrical engineering course, one course, and I loved it. I thought it was the most fun thing I ever did. And I actually decided to change my entire career at that time. So I was accepted at Stanford in physics. And I called up and said I wanted to move from physics to electrical engineering. And Stanford explained how you couldn't do that, how it was hard. Then I asked them, could I move my scholarship money across or my fellowship? And they said, of course not. So I actually traveled from New Hampshire, Dartmouth, to Stanford with no job. And I needed a job to pay my way through school. So I came to the electrical engineering department. I went to the office of the person who ran it, Professor J.D. Mindel at that time, the Integrated Circuit Laboratory, and I asked if I could interview the professor, and his secretary blew me off. She said no. Professor Mindel doesn't even talk to students until they've passed their Ph.D. qualifying exams, and you're just starting on your master's degree. So it wouldn't do you any good to talk to him. So I gave them my resume. I finished number one in physics and number one in chemistry at Dartmouth. I figured that would count. And a day later, I got a call from Professor Mindel. He would see me after all. Turns out that the making of semiconductor devices is physics and high-temperature chemistry. The studying of transistors and wires and other circuit elements is physics. And then the use of, now, today, billions of transistors on a chip is electrical engineering moving its way towards systems engineering. I had my chemistry and physics background, and then I got electrical engineering as the next extension of that. And that was what I still love to do. I still read electrical engineering journals and integrated electronics. I still spend a day and a half a week where I don't do business stuff. I work on technology, and I still love it. I still enjoy it. And if I wanted to retire, I could have retired when I was 30, but I'm 65 now, and I still can retire, and I would never think of that. Having said that I abandoned chemistry, I can tell you that I got interested in wine in 1994 when I moved to a new house in the hills and I had a chance to put in a vineyard. Since that time, I've developed 3 vineyards and 2 wineries, put a lot of money into it, and it rekindled my interest in, believe it or not, organic chemistry. So I actually took out the book that I studied organic chemistry from and reread parts of it to start to understand wine chemistry, which is very complicated. And I now read 2 journals in enology and viticulture, that is winemaking and grape growing, which are heavy on organic chemistry. So now I'm very interested again in organic chemistry.
Thank you for joining us today on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM for our show with Dr. T.J. Rogers, CEO of Cypress Semiconductors. Dr. Rogers got his Ph.D. in electrical engineering from Stanford University, and he has been the CEO of Cypress Semiconductors since 1983. In this section, Dr. Rogers will explain his interest in wine and how studying chemistry, physics, and electrical engineering is helping him design some of the most advanced wineries in the world in California.
When I built my winery, I designed it myself. It's a big winery. It's 30,000 square feet, and it's got all kinds of systems in it that transport heat in various ways, or handle heat that is created by fermentation, or control temperature by transporting heat. So it turns out my background, this is sort of relatively small thermodynamics problems, but nonetheless, I had to pull out the books and remind myself of some of that stuff. Became physics, became interesting to me again. And you can't be in electronics without running into a physics or a chemistry problem two or three a week. What I've always been interested in retrospect is making things. And then when I make something, I want to understand it deeply. And when you understand something deeply, you have to go back to fundamentals.
Could you tell us about the new wine fermenters that you designed, where you use the Cypress semiconductor chips to monitor how wine is being fermented?
There's a fermenter right over in that corner. It's a 55-gallon fermenter. It's really a scientific instrument. So you can ferment 20 gallons of wine from 30 gallons of grapes, and you can control and measure precisely what's going on. No practical winery would ever use that fermenter, but UC Davis, which is the premier enology and viticulture school in the world, has 150 of those. I donated them. I made them, and then I donated them to UC Davis. So that tank is special. We made it. The control of temperature, the measurement of temperature, it's all done by our chips called PSOC. There's a system in there called a pump over where in modern winemaking, not the way I make wine in my own winery, periodically, meaning twice a day, you take a pump and you pump wine from the bottom of the fermenter and then sprinkle it across the top of the grapes in the fermenter. And that pump over is called that rain of wine must. It takes and dissolves the tannin and color from the grapes and the flavor in bouquet elements. So that's required to make wine. In the old days, people would just jump into the tank and push the grape skins down to their feet. And Davis uses a pump over system. So all of the operations of a normal winery are contained in there. They're all computer controlled, so you can precisely control temperature and pump over volume and all of the functions that a winery can control. And then it's got a radio in there, also made by our company. And that radio transmits back to a central personal computer, a big server type computer, all the information from 150 fermentations. So you have in your winery a big dashboard that's got 152 panels on it that will tell you what's going on in every fermenter in detail.
So if wineries were to use this fermenter, would they make better wine?
It's not intended to make better wine. It's intended to understand how wine is made. And then, of course, that will allow you to make better wine in the future. Davis did this last year. When you ferment, the conversion of sugar to alcohol by yeast releases heat and carbon dioxide. And the carbon dioxide causes the grape skins in the fermenter to float on top of the wine. It's called a cap. The French call it the chapeau. Everybody's known about the chapeau for hundreds of years. That cap is hotter than the wine. And that cap can get hotter than the wine by as much as 20 degrees centigrade, typically more like 10. What that means is then the grapes in a fermentation are subjected to an atmosphere of pure carbon dioxide in elevated temperature, and that's what breaks the skins down and releases color and tannin and flavor from the grape skins. So the question naturally comes, should the cap be hotter than the must or the fermenting wine, the liquid? Should the cap be a lot hotter or not as hot? And can you make better or worse wine by controlling the cap temperature independently from the wine temperature? Now, normally, winemakers don't even know what the cap temperature is. I made wine for a decade before I ever even thought about it. And I thought about it because of an experiment they were doing. So you can put real-time temperature probes into the wine and into the cap in various places. It turns out the cap is very non-uniform in its temperature. And measure what's going on and then control it. By using the pump-over system and the cooling system, you can get strategies to control cap temperature differently from the must temperature. And you can determine if more or less tannin, more or less flavor elements, more or less color go into the wine versus how you make the wine. So you can do literally thousands of experiments like that over literally decades. And eventually you understand what makes good wine and bad wine, not as an artist, master winemaker, but from the fundamentals of making wine. So I wouldn't say the best wine in the world could get made better by the scientific understanding, but what I absolutely can say is that, as opposed to France, for example, where you may have three or four good years out of 10, if you understand what goes wrong with making wine, you can have no bad years out of 10.
You're listening to KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. In this section, our guest, Dr. T.J. Rogers, who is a great wine enthusiast and whose wineries include the the Clos de la Tech vineyard in Santa Cruz will explain how he makes his wine.
One of the most famous vineyards in France is Romanée Conti. And Romanée Conti was called La Romanée in 1232, it was known. It makes Pinot Noir, which is my favorite grape, my favorite wine. And since at least 1200, they've been making Pinot Noir. In 1868, they got bought by the Prince de Conti, and they became Romanée-Conti. And it's generally recognized that that wine, at least since the early 1800s, has been the finest Pinot Noir made in the world, period. So Romanée-Conti is to Burgundy and Pinot Noir, as, for example, Chateau Lafite Rothschild or Chateau Latour is to Bordeaux and Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc and Merlot. In the 1830s, Romanée-Conti had a winemaker named Ouvrard who wrote down in detail how he made wine. And, of course, in 1830, yeast had yet to be discovered, so fermentation was magic. There weren't crushers and destemmers. That action was carried out by throwing whole clusters of grapes into a fermenter, which is made out of wood, looking somewhat like a large half barrel set on its end. Crushing was done by foot. Fermentation happened after prayer. St. Augustine was the patron saint of winemaking. And the way the wine fermented at the time actually would lead one to pray, because they didn't know about yeast, and they didn't know that they had about 25 kinds of yeast on their grapes. All different kinds of yeast, only a few of which were actually wine yeast that would ferment sugared alcohol. And it turns out that those yeasts, that this paper was done 2007 time frame by Australian researchers working in Bordeaux. They actually plotted the concentration of the 25 kinds of yeast on a grape in nature from the time the grape was a little green BB to the time the grape was fermented. Turns out different yeasts bloom at different times in a natural fermentation. So the wines at that time were fermented by two or three different kinds of yeast that were very different from each other. The wine yeast, the Saccharomyces, was the last one to come on, and it is the strongest and toughest of all yeast, and it would ferment all of the sugared alcohol and survive the alcohol. Other yeasts would die from their own alcohol that they created. And all that was very complicated, but it turns out it makes really good wine. And it makes wine better, in my opinion, than wine which is inoculated with a purified yeast, which is what many people use today. They'll buy yeast, dried frozen yeast, and put in a single strain of yeast, which will overwhelm the 25 natural kinds of yeast in the fermentation. So, long answer to your question, I make wine the way Ouvrard made wine in the 1830s at Romanée-Conti. I pick the grapes, I have a party, so I have a lot of people, you need extra people, pick off any grape that's got any infirmity or any problem, mold, whatever. I throw the grapes in a container. I don't use wood. I use stainless steel. We stomp the grapes. We do a lot of measurement. Our measurements are way more sophisticated than anything they did. So I have all this panels and data that I'm looking at. But basically, if you were a grape and you got asked the question, what year is it? You would say, I think it's 1832, but I'm touching metal. And I don't know about metal. I should be touching wood. It's the only thing as a grape you'd ever detect different from my winemaking process versus that in Burgundy. We don't have a pump. We use gravity flow. My caves and my big winery are actually at different elevations, different heights, so that we can flow wine from one cave to another through the walls of the cave in order to fill the barrels and to fill the bottles without ever pumping the wine, because they didn't have pumps either. So, very old-fashioned, but I know a lot about the wine when things are happening.
How can we find out more about your wine and which stores in the area carry it?
You can go to clodelatech.com. That's the easiest way to get it. You can go to Robert's store in Woodside. That's my hometown. It's right near Stanford. They've got the wine. Those are the two places that are closest.
Can we distinguish wines by their pH values, and can pH values tell us whether wine is good or bad?
pH is an important property in wine. It's a very complicated property. And actually, the way I got to learn about Davis was reading a paper on the interaction between pH and potassium in wine must, which is complicated, and from a professor at Davis and calling him and having him help me. pH in California, if I could pick pH, I'd pick my grapes, I'd stomp them, I'd measure the pH of the must, and it would be 3.2. And then I would ferment the grapes, and at the end of the fermentation, the pH would have risen from 3.2 to 3.6, and then I put the wine in the bottle. Okay, now what happens is that actually happens. Like this year, that happened. Some years it doesn't. In California, when you have a hot year, your pH goes up. You have too little acid. So in a hot year, the pH will be 3.45 and might go as high as 3.8. And that I don't like. In that case, I break with tradition there, and I'll actually add tartaric acid, which is the natural acid of grapes, into the wine to take the pH down to 3.6. 3.6 is kind of a magic number, 3.55. Some of the Burgundies go down as low as 3.3.
So can the pH value help us determine whether a wine is a good quality or not?
No, because if you ask, is a wine tart, meaning sour, meaning acidic, like lemonade, it's correlated with pH, but there's another parameter called titratable acidity, and basically it's the total acid in the wine that will react with sodium hydroxide, the acid-base reaction. And the titratable acidity is more correlated with a perception of wine taste. And of course, titratable acidity and pH, you can graph one versus the other, and they are very related. But the curve changes from wine to wine. It changes because of potassium. If you take tartaric acid is H2 and then a tartaric anion, you can get hydrogen potassium tartrate. And hydrogen potassium or potassium bitartrate adds to acidity, but it's not as strong as tartaric acid. But potassium in wine, which is a natural part of wine, actually can neutralize acid. So you can have wine that's simultaneously got a lot of titratable acidity in it and it's a high pH, and that's a bad situation. So you got to watch out for that.
Can people buy these very high-tech fermenting tanks today? And which wine journals or magazines do you recommend?
The tanks and the journals I read, if you're not a degreed chemist, they're pretty hard to read. The tank you'd never buy because it's really a scientific instrument to do experiments in. Although my tanks and my wine are exactly like that, only 10 to 20 times bigger. And we use the same process. If you want to read about wine, you're just a home winemaker, Practical Wine and Vineyard is a nice magazine to read. I still read it. My wife reads it, and if it's laying on the table, I'll pick it up. The journals I read are the Journal of Oenology and Viticulture, which is a fairly high-level journal, and then the Australian Journal of Grape and Wine Research, which, again, is a high-level journal. So unless you're a chemist, and even a biologist, because there's a lot of biology in these things too, those journals are kind of tough to read.
You're listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Today we are very privileged that our guest is Dr. TJ Rogers, CEO of Cypress Semiconductors. In this section, Dr. Rogers will discuss how he decided to become an entrepreneur and his journey after graduating from Stanford with a PhD in electrical engineering until he started Cypress Semiconductors in 1983.
When I graduated from Dartmouth, I had taken one electrical engineering course, and I was in my car hoping to get a job in electrical engineering at Stanford. At that time, I already knew that I wanted to be a CEO of a company, and I already said that my target had been to run a company by the time I was 35 years old. I'd never heard the word Silicon Valley until I got to Stanford, and until I started talking with other students in Integrated Circuit Lab, I never got the concept that there were a lot of companies out here making transistors. I had gotten interested in using transistors to make circuits at Dartmouth. When I got out here, I found out I could make the transistors that I used. And of course, that's one step farther up in the food chain as far as I'm concerned. So I then refined it to I want to run a semiconductor company by the time I'm 35. I spent from 1970 to 75 at Stanford getting my MS and PhD. I'd won two best paper awards in the International Solid State Circuits Conference, which is a big conference in our industry. So I was a graduate student who was known. And then I got wined and dined by the people in Silicon Valley. I got wined and dined by Gordon Moore and Robert Noyce and Andy Grove at Intel. I chose not to go to Intel. That was a mistake. I picked a company called American Microsystems, which was actually bigger at Intel that time and older. I worked there for 5 years. I learned a lot about practical engineering. I learned a lot about large teams of engineers, not one person making stuff, which is what I was used to in the laboratory. And then I left AMI after failure. AMI worked on a patent of mine for 5 years, spent a lot of money on it, and it failed. So my first venture in the industry was a disaster for the company I worked for. I then decided to go to a company that had commercial success, and I again interviewed at Intel, and Intel's arch rival, Advanced Micro Devices, and I went to AMD, worked for Jerry Sanders at AMD. That was a lot of fun for 3 years.
So when did you first try to start Cypress Semiconductors?
I tried to start a company in 79 and I couldn't do it because of my first failure at AMI. Nobody would fund me. Then I went to AMD from 79 to 82. And by 1982, the Japanese were beating up on the American semiconductor industry very badly. I kind of gave up hope that I could ever have a company because people were saying we were going to lose to the Japanese and there was no chance for our industry. I, by accident, another accident, took a call from a venture capitalist who was funding a company that didn't make it. And he was doing a reference check on one of the engineers in the company that had worked for me. And I told the venture capitalist who was in New York, if he had money to fund the company, I had a business plan, and it was a better business plan than the one he was funding. So he invited me out. By accident, I was going to New York the next week to do paper selection for the conference, ISSCC, where I'd won the best paper. I engaged with the venture capitalist. His name was Ben Rosen. He sent me to Dallas to talk to his partner, LJ7, who had been the president of the seventh biggest chip company in the U.S., a company called MasTec. LJ is a good old boy, Texas good old boy. He's born in Louisiana. Picked me up at the airport in a big Cadillac, stopped and put gas in his own car. I gave him a business plan that I wrote in the airplane, 7 pages long in pencil. Told me the plan didn't look nearly as bad as he thought it was going to look. And he and his partner in New York funded Cypress. We got funded on April 7th, 1983. That's our funding launching date, and that's the date we kicked off. And our first product was what I worked on in my last two jobs. I worked on static random access memory. That's the high-performance memory that sits right next to the processor, the computer, and is able to store and retrieve data at the same rate the computer creates and uses data. So it's a high-performance memory. We still do it today. We're number one in the world, and we ship about $400 million a year in static RAMs today.
Thank you for joining us today for our show with Dr. T.J. Rogers, CEO of Cypress Semiconductors. I asked Dr. Rogers to explain how he was able to recognize opportunities throughout his studies at Stanford and his career in Silicon Valley. To begin, I asked him to explain how he was able to get into the electrical engineering department at Stanford.
That wasn't so much about recognizing opportunity, but really about what I said before. I had lost my passion to be a physics graduate student and perhaps a physics professor somewhere. And I had gained a huge passion for working on chips. So I just said, that's what I want to work on. So I followed my passion, going back to the, should you inspire your children to work in science? Only if they want to. So that was about really working on something I wanted to work on. The recognizing opportunity, you know, I could give you a big story and talk about I have the strategic thinking and I have a vision that looks forward. But the fact is, I don't. And I don't think many people do. And if you go back to the book Outliers, it's more about being in the right place at the right time. For example, Bill Gates was there exactly when the personal computer came into existence, and he happened to be interested in software and computer programming. That was his passion. And he happened to have been working on his passion long enough that he was really good at it. So he had a combination of a high skill in an important area right at the right time when it was needed, and then that turned into Microsoft. Now, you can say from the time Bill Gates was a mere teenager, he had a vision of creating Microsoft. That's not true. So in my case, I worked on what I liked to work on. I worked on it very hard because I loved working on it, not because I had to. And then I showed up in Silicon Valley in 1970. And, you know, when I showed up in Silicon Valley, Intel was 2 years old. And National Semiconductor was 3 years old, and AMD was 1 year old. So I was in the right place at the right time. Why did they show up in Silicon Valley? There's a major strategic choice. I was accepted at 9 schools, 4 business schools, and 5 engineering schools. I was accepted to Caltech, MIT, Princeton, Stanford, etc. I chose Stanford because I had this vision. That was California. California was surfing and the Beach Boys, who were popular at the time. So I went to California thinking California, you know, was surfing land. When I first got to the beach, I was very disappointed because the water was so cold, you pretty much had to wear a wetsuit even to go into it. And there wasn't any surfing at that time. Now there's more surfing. So I went to Stanford. Now, if I'd have chosen to go to MIT, I would have gotten interested in some other form of electrical engineering. I would have done something else, and I'd be an East Coast person right now. So that was accidental. There's no big strategy in it.
How did you recognize the business opportunities for Cypress Semiconductors and manage to keep Cypress Semiconductors a leading company in its field for all those years?
One is I talked about passion for something. Second thing I talked about was being in the right place at the right time. And I think most success stories are more explained about by passion plus being in the right place at the right time than some grand strategy a teenager has. The third thing, which is the longevity of this company, to my knowledge, and I checked this, and I checked it 5 years ago, I am the longest tenured chief executive officer of any significant publicly traded electronics company in the world by a bunch of years. So that longevity is not accidental. That has more to do with having a combination of traits, tenacity and priority. Many CEOs, soon to be non-CEOs, and this happens to people all over all the time, they will ascend to power for doing something right. And then once they get into power, everybody seeks to eliminate the chaos of fighting your way into existence and survival. So you build a company, you have vice presidents, you have a board of directors, you put money in the bank. You build divisions that participate in different markets so you won't get killed if one of your markets goes away. Many CEOs, when they get to that point, say 10 years in, if they survive 10 years, the average tenure of CEO is about 5 years, go on autopilot, and then all of a sudden they take on something new. It's not necessarily something bad, but something new. They become philanthropic. They become interested in other ventures. They become interested in politics. And all of a sudden, the company is something that sort of runs on autopilot when you're off doing your new thing. And I've never done that. One trait I've always had is I am the CEO of Cypress Semiconductor, and my job is to make Cypress Semiconductor grow profitably to the best of my ability, period. That's what I do for a living. And I always subordinate everything else to that goal. And most CEOs don't during the long term. They may in the beginning, but they lose it after a while. I'll give you an example. I told you a long story about physics and chemistry. Turns out that enabled me at Stanford to make transistors. I'm one of the few people in the world who was in the right place, Stanford, at the Stanford IC Laboratory at the right time that I made transistors with my own hands for 3 years. No help from anybody. There was a laboratory full of equipment. I would check out a silicon wafer, and I would run it for a couple of days. I was fast making transistors, and I would make transistors that would be real transistors or integrated circuits that I had fabricated. That was my passion, and I came into the industry exactly when that skill, how to make chips work, was hard to do. That's no longer hard to do today. That's a given. We have foundries, quote-unquote foundries today, that make chips, and you can buy them. Great chips. You have to design it, but you make them yourself. So recently, our company had to make a decision to stop making its own chips. So in effect, the economics of running your own wafer fabrication plant and continuing on Moore's Law, building new chip factories every 2 years, cost now over $1 billion, well over $1 billion, was no longer economical for an $800 million company. So we had to stop building new plants and making the next generation of chip and start buying our chips from somebody else. In effect, we had to stop doing exactly what I did for a living for all of my life, let somebody else do that, and start working on other things in integrated circuits, the chips themselves, and the software that runs the chips. And I gave that up. So I didn't retire because my era was over. I didn't continue to make chips even though it was uneconomical, which is something a lot of companies do. You know, Kodak was still messing around selling and developing film right when they went out of business. So did Polaroid. So you get used to doing something and being the best in the world at something, and then all of a sudden that thing is no longer needed in the world and you run into a brick wall. So one of the things we've done is we've changed, major change, who we are multiple times during our 30-year lifetime. We would no longer be alive today if we were a RAM, static RAM company, made memories from technologies in our own fabs. We would not exist today if we hadn't morphed from that. And the changes are very painful. You have to, for example, part ways with people that you recruited that are doing chip work that you no longer can do, that are your friends that you actually worked with, because you can't afford to do that anymore. You got to do something else. So you have to be willing to put, in effect, your shareholders' interest, that is the well-being of the company, ahead of your own interests, and make all your decisions with that criterion. That's very hard.
Did the work done by Cypress's research labs and forecasting departments help make the decisions of where to lead Cypress Semiconductors easier?
Sure, but you say that like you can walk in the front door or the back door, like it's simple. It's not simple. It's very hard. For example, if I had chosen to have a biochemistry division, we'd be out of business right now. Because in professional engineering companies, you also have to be very close to being the best in the world to survive. When we started Cypress in 1983, our funding year, there were 57 semiconductor companies in the U.S. Of the 57, all but 15 are now defunct, gone, dead. Your chances of survival in our industry are way less than 50-50 over a 30-year period. So, yeah, I can say I can go into A or B or C, or, you know, why don't I compete with Google and start working on search engines? But the answer is I can't, because the DNA, my DNA, and the DNA of our company makes us world-class in an area where we can compete. And we compete against the Japanese. We actually took market share away from them eventually and became number one in the world. And if you're not in an area where you're absolutely world-class in your talent, you won't survive. So you can't just hop into something that's cool. You have to move into an adjacent area where if you learn very quickly and very painfully, you have a chance sort of to hop onto the next iceberg.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. And now it's time for our PSAs. Every year, the Second Harvest Food Bank of Santa Clara and San Mateo counties distributes nearly 30 million pounds of food to people in need, right here in our community. But they can't do it without your help. To find out how to contribute to their programs, volunteer your time, or start your own food drive, call the Second Harvest Food Bank at 866-234-3663 or visit their website shfb.org. That's shfb.org. Kickstart is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to lift millions of people in Africa out of poverty quickly, cost-effectively, and sustainably. Co-founded by Stanford alumnus Dr. Martin Fisher, Kickstart designs, promotes, and markets simple money-making tools that small farmers buy and use to start profitable family enterprises. You can help families permanently change their lives by contributing to Kickstart. For more information, visit kickstart.org. How and when did you and Cypress Semiconductors become involved with the nonprofit organization Second Harvest Food Bank?
That is another accident, really. When you're starting a company and you have no money, and if your company doesn't do well, you will be broke. You don't think about philanthropy. You think about surviving. You think about not laying off your employees. You think about making your company, taking it public, and having it survive. Then if you do that well enough for a period of time, if your company's successful, you go public and make a bunch of money, at least put a bunch of money in the bank. And at that time, you can think about philanthropy. I didn't. I was still focusing on the company. We had a PR event, and I was asked to be the chairman of the Second Harvest Food Bank, first executive chairman. So Second Harvest Food Bank, I'd never heard of. They fed hungry people in San Mateo and Santa Clara County. Think about it as a grocery store with no cash register. And they asked me if I'd help, and I thought about it, and I said, okay, fine, I'll try to figure out how this thing works. So I was the first chairman. I learned a lot about Second Harvest Food Bank. I had been skeptical of many charities. There had been some scandals where money donated to charity hadn't been used properly, got used by the executives. There's a website now, Charity Watch or something like that, that monitors the efficiency of charities. But at that time, I just had a little bit of a cloud in my mind over many charities that I was wondering if donations went to the people it was intended for or to the executives of the charity. So Second Harvest Food Bank, I checked that out right away, and the answer was it was mostly donations, mostly people donating their time, and their fall through was 95% the money given them went to food for people. So they were truly a charity that did what they wanted, did what their passion was, so we worked with them. And we set a record for the most donations food per person for a company. And that record we've won every year since 1993, our company. So we get involved in it, you know more about it, you go over there and sort food. You have events in your company building up over the holidays to donate money. Some are fun parties that you charge $20 to get into, which is a donation. Some are dumb, you charge people a can of food in order to go to a meeting. You build food sculptures, which we did for a bunch of years, where you build multi-ton sculptures, room-filling sculptures, and big room-filling sculptures of food. So anyway, I got into it more over time, and I put more money into it over time, and that's my number one charity right now. And then I've gotten to donate to other charities as well. Not on the scale I donate to Second Harvest Food Bank, but whenever I see a charity whose objectives I align with and whose efficiency is exemplary, then I give money. And today I've got what's called a DAF, or Donor Advised Fund, where you basically put in money that you donate to charity without specifying the charity. So it's kind of like a bank account where money is donated, and then from time to time you call them up and say, give some money to Dartmouth College, give some money to Second Harvest Food Bank. So it's a way to give money, and you can schedule when you put money into it. You don't have to all of a sudden come up with money for some given event or something like that. And it's a good way to give money. So that's what I do. I don't spend a lot of time on it. When you're 65 years old, you suddenly realize that, not suddenly, it comes on you that eventually all your money is going to go to somebody. And then you start thinking about where it's going to go. And that's when I started the DAF, and I started planning for how my money would get used. Personally, I have a nice car, I have a nice house, but I don't live extravagantly. I travel coach. I don't take extravagant vacations. So pretty much all the stock I've ever got in Cyprus, I still own. So I own, I think it's about 9% of Cyprus. I'm the second largest shareholder. There's one institution, I think it's Fidelity Fund, that owns more Cyprus than I do, and I own more than everybody else.
In a time when many CEOs around the world like to have private jets and many houses around the world, how did you avoid being part of that scene?
Well, that's part of my background. My hometown is Oshkosh, Wisconsin. It's a Midwest conservative area. Conspicuous consumption is frowned on as being tacky. I also am much more interested in creating things, wineries, chips, systems, etc. Much more interested in creating things than I am in consuming things. Like I said, I have a nice car, I have a nice house, and certainly many people would consider either of them to be really great, but I don't, for example, have 8 houses all over the world and travel in a private jet in order to go to my 8 houses and have, you know, some exotic sports car various places. I just don't do that. I'm not interested in it. It's not that I wouldn't use my own money that I've earned and pay taxes on it. If I wanted to, it's just not my interest.
You just mentioned taxes, and since you're one of the top 1% bracket in this country, what do you think of what Warren Buffett recently said, that rich people in America should be paying more taxes than they are today?
I think Warren Buffett and his statements about what rich people ought to do clearly mark him as a hypocritical fool. He simultaneously pontificates on what taxes people ought to pay when 2 of his investments are being sued by the Internal Revenue Service for not having paid taxes, accumulates a lot of money at a low tax rate, and then after his money's accumulated and under his control, then he says the rest of the world should not be able to accumulate money and the taxes should be raised. I don't like him at all. I don't like what he says. What he's saying is socialistic. If Warren Buffett hadn't lived in a free economy, Warren Buffett wouldn't have the money he's got. I'm not knocking his skill. He's done a great job creating a business, which is, by the way, isn't all that competitive anymore. He's not doing that great in the competition. You know, everybody talks about the Oracle of Omaha and how great he is. The fact is he's kind of living on the legacy. And there are other firms that compete against him that do a better job today. But the fact is he did a very good job for a long time and piled up a bunch of money. And if he wants to give it away, that's great. Eventually, it will all be given away anyway because he's going to die. So to say that people should give away money is sort of like saying the obvious. Otherwise, if that weren't true, people wouldn't die. So that's kind of obvious. But then for him to say what people ought to pay statement is one against free markets, which is what allowed him to make his money, to me is, again, hypocritical. Also, it's counterproductive and very destructive. It's very foolish, and I mean foolish, okay? So, for example, he made his money because he had a low tax rate. Why did he have a low tax rate? He had a low tax rate because he made his money in capital gains. What does capital gain mean? Capital gains means he put money into an enterprise and built it up. So, in effect, he bought stock in a company and then caused the company to be worth a lot more money because it became more important, bigger, created jobs, and made a better economy. And then the stock he held in the company was worth a lot more money. And then when you sell that stock, you pay a capital gains tax, so think 15%. And the capital gains tax is lower than the income tax rate some people might pay, think 30%. That's exactly right and moral to do. Warren Buffett was given a tax incentive by our governments, not because they liked him or he lobbied, but because it makes sense for our country to give lower tax rates to people who build companies, build jobs, and build the economy, as opposed to other people who earn money and spend it on cars and vacations. So the tax rate is heavier on consumption and lesser on creation of economy and jobs. And he knows that. He's not foolish. He's into politics, and whenever he speaks, I always look for the angle he's working for himself. I don't think he's the great benefactor he claims to be.
You're listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest today is Cypress Semiconductor CEO Dr. T.J. Rogers. Dr. Rogers believes in free enterprise because it's through free enterprise that he was able to become one of America's top 1%. He is a self-made man, and in the next section, he will discuss why free enterprise is important.
I used to get angry about the socialistic ramblings of, for example, President Carter. It used to bother me that the lack of understanding they had of the economy, which, if followed, would cause disaster in the economy. Like our current president and the one before him, George Bush and Barack Obama have been back-to-back disasters for the economy. They've been back-to-back disasters for taking money from people and spending the money and using the money through the government very inefficiently. I used to get really worked up about that, but I'm still just too interested in working on things and doing things to let that pull me down. But I'll just tell people, every time you vote to take money away from the productive sectors of the economy, whichever ones they are, and put it in the government, you have destroyed jobs. Just remember that. Every time you vote to take money away from private investment and put it in the government, you voted to destroy jobs. And when you destroy jobs, you are voting to harm the weakest of our citizens. I don't care if there's a recession any longer, but I'll tell you that if I'm working for minimum wage somewhere in a company that's right on the edge, I really care a lot about being laid off. And when the economy goes backwards, it harms the weakest among us. So it's nice to pontificate the great moral cause of giving money to the government or having the government take money from you with threat of jail and then redistributing money to create jobs and government industry partnerships and all that political blather they put out. But the fact is it's going backwards. If you look at private investment, small business investment, it takes an investment of about $30,000. Think about renting a building, putting in a pizza oven, buying some tables and chairs. It takes an investment of about $30,000 to create a job. If you look at the latest stimulus package by our latest president, the Congressional Budget Office, CBO, first of all, it can't count the jobs very well, so their estimates are very, very wide range. But their estimate is that it takes between $500,000 and $4 million per job. So in this current stimulus package, we're spending, pick a number, $1 to $2 million a job to create jobs, whereas small business, without a doubt, creates jobs for $30,000 each. And it turns out, when I read those statistics in an article, I went and looked at my own investments. I looked at Cyprus, and I looked at, we're now creating money. We don't use money anymore. You don't invest in us anymore. We create money and put money back into the economy. But if I look at the point when we were at our lowest, when we had taken all the money that we had taken, and in fact our bank account was the most negative, that we sold a lot of stock and hadn't put the money back in the economy yet, we created about 4,000 jobs for a cost of about $300,000 each. So for a high-tech company where I have to buy wafer fabs and things that are really expensive to create a job, our cost of creating a job is $300,000, which is something like 2 to 6 times cheaper than government stimulus programs. I also have invested in a restaurant in my hometown of Oshkosh, and I spent $1 million building a nice lakefront restaurant in my hometown, and I've created 65 jobs there. So for that, which is low-tech, doesn't require a lot of investment, my investment per job created was $18,000. So in my own life, my cost per creating a job is between $18,000 and $300,000. So all you have to do is tax away my money, take the money. I don't need the money. I'm not saying it's like I will starve. But all you do is take my money away by taxing it away so I don't get to invest it. Somebody else gets to invest it. Congress, pork barrel, processing. And you're going to lose a significant number of jobs because I won't be investing, because money will be gone and the government will be investing, and they'll be investing somewhere between 3 and 10 times less efficiently than I did. And that's true of the private economy. So this hocus pocus about we'll be better off if we tax people more is just wrong, just factually incorrect.
So what do you do to share your views on free enterprise with the public?
I do nothing about it. And the reason I do nothing about it is very simple. First of all, I detest politics and I detest politicians. There are a few exceptions, but in general, I believe that politicians are the lowest life forms on the face of the earth. I deal in a world where facts, knowledge, integrity matter. And if you look at politicians, look at Congress, look at their rating. Everybody knows they have no integrity. Everybody knows they lie pretty much every time they open their mouth. And I'm talking Democrats and Republicans. This is not a liberal conservative kind of thing. So why would I want to be involved with that group? My tax rate, to a first approximation, if you take all the taxes I pay, not sales tax and other taxes on top of it, I'm talking income, my tax rate's about 55%, 52%. Okay, and I just pay it. And somebody says, well, why don't you do something about that? Well, okay, I could go into politics. I could run for state senate or senator from California or House member from California, spend the rest of my life living in an environment with people I really don't like. And maybe if I were some sort of, could be, and I couldn't because I'm too blunt to live in a world where you can't say the truth, the political world, I might be able to reduce my tax rate. It would be an overwhelming victory if my tax rate and people in my category, the top 1%, I'm proud to be a 1%er, I might reduce the tax rate by 10 percentage points from 55 to 45%. Okay, now look at the other TJ that doesn't champion tax reduction, ignores the people who take your money, and just takes whatever they leave him behind and builds jobs with it. So I keep, let's say, 50% of my money. I'm a 10x guy. That is, when I invest in something, it doesn't grow by 5% or 10% or a factor of 2. Over a period of 5 or more years, it's worth 10 times more. Okay, so in one case, my income's 100%. I get taxed 50%. I reduce my taxes from 50 to 40%. And I get 10% more of my income, okay, because it didn't get taxed. The other guy says, keep the 50%. Knock yourself out. I'll take the 50% you don't take from me. And 5 years later, that 50% is worth 500%. So in one case, I work on things I don't want to work on with people I detest and save 10%. In the other case, I work on what I love to work on with only the money that's left, and I make 500%. So it's foolish for me to play in political circles. I've testified in front of Congress 6 times, and most times my theme has been corporate welfare is bad. Don't give money to corporations, and I believe that. When I was going to do my first testimony, I knew Milton Friedman fairly well, and I bragged to him that I was called to Washington to testify. In this case, it was on Japanese-American competitiveness and what America should do about it. And the answer was, of course, subsidized semiconductors, which is a horrible answer. And I was all pumped up in the issue, and I was getting my talk ready. And he said, well, I used to do that, but it's a total waste of time. And I gave you the long version about the two TJs, one that just builds wealth and the other one that tries to reduce taxes. And he had his own calculus on that. He says, it's a waste of time. They don't care what you say. They've already made up their mind. The lobbyists help them do what they want to do. And then when you testify, they simply want to take sound bites and paragraphs from what you say to use to justify what they already decided before he showed up. And he was so cynical, I said, oh, this can't be. So I went to Washington, and actually my talk was well received. And I thought, well, he's kind of bitter. I mean, he's wrong. My last time I went to Washington, the sixth time, I traveled 6 hours in an airplane. I spent all 6 hours condensing 2 hours worth of information into a 6-minute condensation of the outline of how to think your way through this problem. I walked into a Senate committee. I remember there was Senator Leahy from the state of IBM, also known as Vermont. Senator Leahy was there, and I was speaking against subsidies for corporations. And of course, IBM was getting subsidies from Sematech at the time, and I was speaking against that. So Leahy didn't like me. And Senator Metzenbaum from Ohio. So only two senators showed up of a panel of eight. Leahy ignored me. He was working on papers and didn't acknowledge that I was there. He didn't listen to me, and he didn't say thank you for your testimony when I left. In that chamber, there was a green light, yellow light, red light system. They turn on the green light, and after 3 minutes, it would get yellow, and after 3 more minutes, it would turn red, and your 6 minutes was up. So Metzenbaum looked at his watch and said, we're running late for lunch today. We're going to cut you down to 3 minutes, and he flipped on the yellow light. And then I started to scramble real time to say what I had to say in 3 minutes, which, of course, was impossible. And then the red light went on, and he cut me off. When I walked out of that, I said, Milton Friedman is right. These people deserve a 10% popularity rating. The fact that they're making significant choices for us, the way they make them, I will never come back to this place again. And that was 15 years ago.
In the final few minutes of today's interview, Dr. T.J. Rogers will tell us what advice he has for students at Stanford.
Well, if you take Stanford, you have a huge opportunity. You're in one of the greatest institutions in the world. You have an opportunity to learn, which will carry you for the rest of your life. One thing I would say, like I said, you should work on what your passion is. That's the most important thing. But you should also bias toward fundamentals. Things come and things go. Electron tubes come, they go. Semiconductors come, they go. Quantum computing may be next, but the point is, a person who understands physics and chemistry will always be able to understand what the trend is in the world. But a person who studied only a very narrow thing and more of a technician type breadth as opposed to a wide breadth for basic science is less well suited for the future, which you don't know what it's going to be, and neither do I. So I'd say work on basics. I would say work hard. The number of hours being spent studying today is less than it was 20 years ago by college students. Oh, yeah, that's a fact. I would say you have a tremendous opportunity to work your rear end off. Take Saturday night off, maybe part of Sunday, but you should be working a lot more than you're not working. And it's not to say don't have social activities, but you have an opportunity that very few people in the world have. Don't come back being the president of your sorority as the biggest thing you ever did when you were in school.
You've been listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Thank you for joining us today, and we would also like to thank our guest, Dr. T.J. Rogers, very much for his time and for this interview. If you would like to download a copy of this interview, please download it from our website, moderntechnews.com. That's moderntechnews.com.